Once upon a midnight weary, artists of Iowa discovered something quite dreary. In a pandemic year, an evil villain is out to steal the holiday cheer.
No live entertainment? Get out! No way! I'll save it myself if I have to. I'll do it today.
Join Iowa Public Radio Studio 1 and XBK for The Holiday Special, an original musical for a pandemic year, at 7 p.m. on Sunday, December 20th.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. On Monday, Iowa hospitals began vaccinating frontline workers. Later in the hour, I'll talk with a physician from the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics who was among the first to be inoculated. Dr. Patrick Hartley will join us later on in the hour. But first, the economic fallout from this pandemic has left more Iowans without enough affordable, nutritious food. So in the first part of our program today, we want to hear from some leaders of organizations in the state that are fighting food insecurity. Let's first talk with Michelle Book. She is the CEO of the Food Bank of Iowa. Michelle, welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me here today, Ben.
For those who may not know your organization well, introduce us to it. Give us an idea of the many, many places across the state you serve Iowans in need.
Well, thank you, Ben. Food Bank of Iowa is a member of Feeding America. We are one of five Feeding America food banks that serve the state of Iowa to make sure that all Iowans have enough food to feed their families. Food Bank of Iowa covers 55 counties, about 30,000 square miles of Iowa. Our job is to find food, keep it safe, and get it back out to our over 600 partner agencies, food pantries, school, and social services agencies that then hand it to the folks in their communities that are struggling to make ends meet.
Mm-hmm. Food insecurity, Michelle, is a word we use a lot in the news. What does it really mean in human terms?
Yeah, actually, Ben, food insecurity is a USDA term. But the bottom line is folks that live in a food insecure place, live in a place of fear and scarcity, they don't have food in their refrigerator, they don't have their food in their cupboards on a reliable basis, and they often scrape together to put food on the table for their families.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what is the need like now compared to pre-COVID times? How has food insecurity increased?
Well, food insecurity is not a new phenomenon in the state of Iowa. Before COVID struck, about 10%, 9 to 10% of Iowan citizens lived in poverty, and poverty and food insecurity definitely go hand in hand. With the onset of COVID, so many people we all know, friends, family, neighbors, lost precious work hours, their employment altogether, or businesses they had closed. So immediately we saw a huge surge in need for food assistance. And Feeding America, of which we're a member, reported early in the summer that food insecurity had doubled and tripling for those folks, those households which have children. Mm-hmm. We also know from studying past recessions and the relationship with food insecurity to those recessions that the food insecurity from the recession we're currently in, the food insecurity needs are not likely to peak until 2024 and most likely will not recede again to pre-recession levels until 2027, 2028. Mm-hmm. So this is a problem that continues to escalate. It will be an ongoing problem for a number of years for organizations such as ourselves trying to help your neighbor that doesn't have enough food for their table.
Michelle, do you know how many in Iowa are reaching out to Food Bank of Iowa, for instance, getting food assistance for the first time, where this is a new experience to have to reach out to an organization like yours?
We had about 375,000 Iowans across the state that were estimated to be in a place of food insecurity before COVID. We're seeing in Northwestern, University of Institute, Advocacy Institute has reported that Iowa is at 2.73 times the number of food insecure folks than pre-COVID. We have seen here at the Food Bank of Iowa within our organization double the demand. We have many people reaching out for the first time. We had a large distribution at the Iowa State Fairgrounds a month ago, serving about 5,000 households. 60% of those people reported never having had to ask for help before in order to feed their families.
Mm. And what are your biggest challenges right now with this dramatic uptick in need?
Distribution was immediately our biggest challenge. How do we get food out, more food out to more people, but do it in a safe manner? So we have, I'll use the popular word of the times, we're all pivoting, and we certainly did pivot at the Food Bank of Iowa to a new distribution model where clients would go into pantries selecting the items that they would like to take home to prepare for their family for dinner. We've now gone to a pre-curated, pre-boxed set of staple groceries, fresh produce, meat, eggs, and cheese that we put in the trunk of the individuals that our pantry partners place in the trunk of clients that are asking for a little bit of help. We've also had to find ways to get more food into our distribution center and get it back out to our pantry partners quickly. We've added trucks to our fleet. We've added a couple of drivers. We have several new distribution routes that we didn't have 8-9 months ago. We also relied a good amount during this period of time on additional food being provided to us by the United States Department of Agriculture. The USDA Commodity Food Program was providing additional food to us. We fear that that will drop off in January.
Mm-hmm. How have you been working with families with kids, especially, I ask, because especially some kids aren't going to schools, physically going to schools, attending online, and I know a lot of school districts are trying to keep up with school lunches and so forth, even when the kids don't physically appear in school. But how does that impact your service?
Yeah, it... Then it really is the kids I worry about the most. And just here in Metro Des Moines, in the Des Moines Public School District, last school year, before COVID, but last school year, they reported that nearly 80% of their population qualified for free and reduced breakfast, lunch, and after-school snacks from the federal government. Well, that does very little good if the children aren't in the actual classroom to take advantage of those meals. So we do know that about 40% of our distribution today goes to youth, individuals aged 0 to 18, and another 40% goes to folks 20 to 60 that would have children in their households. Mm-hmm. This has been a particularly hard hit to kids and their households with kids out of school right now. Hopefully the vaccine will get more kids in school and kids will get back to that place of safety and security where they can take advantage of USDA-provided breakfast, lunch, and after-school snacks.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about the consequences past being hungry, having an empty refrigerator, no nutritious food or little nutritious food, especially for young people. What are the consequences of growing up when you have a period of food insecurity in your home for that individual?
Well, there are a series of reports that have been done year over year. We do know that kids that don't have enough to eat don't learn as well. Often they have behavioral outbursts. We know that there's stress in those households from the parents. It must be a very difficult position to be in to not be able to provide food for your children. So you can imagine the stress in those households. Mm-hmm. These children grow up with long-term mental health issues that pursue them into adulthood. They also learn to eat foods that are quick, easy, cheap, inexpensive, carb-rich, calorie-dense, because those are the kinds of meals that will tide you over longer and cost less. Those eating habits into adulthood lead to diabetes, obesity, heart disease. So growing up in a food insecure household creates a lot of challenges for kids while they're youth, but also challenges that follow them into adulthood.
Before we say goodbye, Michelle, I wanted to make sure we got some information out to any of the listeners who want to help or perhaps need help. Let's talk about those who want to help. Do you have enough volunteers?
Early on, many of our corporate groups canceled. We sent out a plea for help, and volunteers have responded. We do have volunteer spaces available. If you're interested in volunteering, I suggest you go to our website, foodbankiowa.org.
Okay. And what if you feel you may need some help with food? How do you approach that? The same website, foodbankiowa.org?
Food insecurity is harsh any time of year, but particularly so at the holidays. If you need help, please, please go to our website, foodbankiowa.org, put in your zip code, and there will be pantries near you. That information will be provided to you. Please, if you need help, go to foodbankiowa.org today.
Mm-hmm. And do you have to pass any sort of needs test to qualify for this sort of food service?
Most of our pantries that we work with do not require that you show an ID. Some in the Des Moines area, the DMARC pantries, some of those allow just a once a month distribution. But most of our pantries across our 55 counties, if you call them, I encourage you call in advance of showing up in case hours have changed. But if you call them, they will provide assistance.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much. Michelle Book, CEO of Food Bank of Iowa. Once again, that website, if you want to help, reach out and help. foodbankiowa.org, also a place where you can find out more information on how to get help if you are in a food insecure family. Michelle Book, thank you for the information, especially during this holiday season. So important to make sure people are not food insecure. Thank you.
Thank you, Ben.
Talking about one of the aspects of the economic fallout from this pandemic this half hour. It's left more Iowans without enough affordable, nutritious food. So we're talking with those in the state fighting food insecurity. Let's next talk with Zuli Garcia. She is involved with a nonprofit organization, Latinx Knock and Drop Iowa. Zuli, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Yours is a new organization, I understand. Tell us about Latinx Knock and Drop and why it was started.
Yes, it's definitely new. We started mid-pandemic in March of this year. And the reason why we started it was because there is no Latino food pantry. And so because of the language barrier, because of the insecurity that's out there right now, because of people not feeling secured and not knowing if they can tell someone what their need is, we decided, a group of volunteers, that we were going to step up. And it started as a project, and now it's turned into a full-blown organization serving our Latinx community and others that are in need if we have food. And so basically what we do is we're culturally specific for our Latino community. We have rice, we have sweet bread, we have the USDA boxes, as they were talking about, and other stuff that we received within our local businesses that can provide us and give us food to help out our Latinx community.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's dig into those couple things you mentioned there. Why does the Latinx community not, I mean, going to a regular food pantry? We just heard about an organization that looks over, you know, supervises and is involved with so many pantries across the state. Why doesn't that work especially well for our Latino community?
It does not work. It works most of the time, but when they are in a stress mode, as we all are in right now with the pandemic, a lot of them don't feel secure. A lot of them don't know if someone's going to understand them because of the language barrier, or, you know, they've gone into some places, and I don't know, I can't tell you specific ones, where they specifically ask for like an identification. Mm-hmm. And so they feel like, you know, I can't provide the ID that you're needing from me, and I can't explain it to you. And there's just that huge language barrier. On top of, you know, it's easier when you have someone that can speak your language and looks like you to make you feel comfortable and ask you, do you need anything else? You know, is there anything else we can help you with? And I'm sure there's a ton of people out there that do the same thing and help our community. It just, it's that language barrier that, you know, makes them insecure and makes them not want to go. And a lot of that is, you know, I think a lot of them are too proud because they've been working hard this whole time. And because of the pandemic, they've lost hours, they've lost their jobs, and they're just afraid to go out and ask. They don't want to be that public, under that public assistance. You know, they're afraid, what is that going to affect me in the future? And I've heard that from so many, is I don't want to ask for anything because I don't want that to hurt me in the future.
Okay, interesting here, too. I wonder if you can dig more into those kind of personal stories, anonymous, keeping them anonymous. But what stories have you heard about food insecurity in the Latino community? Go past the numbers into some of the real households that you've heard about.
So when we started, you know, we started delivering food to people because we called it Knock and Drop Iowa for a specific reason. We wanted our volunteers and our families to feel secure that, you know, we weren't going to have interaction. We were just going to knock and drop the food. And one of my volunteers came back and said, you have no idea what I just experienced. And I'm thinking, oh, my gosh, what happened? And she says, the kids see me coming with a box of food and they're screaming at the top of their lungs from their balcony, the food is coming, Mom, the food is coming. And so they knock on her door, they drop it, and she comes out and she's crying because she's saying, I didn't have any food. I didn't know how I was going to feed my kids. And I get those messages all the time to our organization Facebook page or as an email from families that are saying, thank you. Thank you for the tortillas that we got. Thank you for the cheese. We were able to make quesadillas and we had food tonight. Thank you for that milk because I didn't have any milk. And my child said, it's okay, Mom, if we don't have any milk. I can put water in my cereal. So those types of stories hit me because I thought, how can that be? How can we live in a country and in a state where we should feel comfortable and we should feel secure, but we have kids that are going to bed hungry at night?
That's enough to bring really tears to your eyes listening to the story, Zuli. This is very important work you're doing. Your organization, Latinx Knock and Drop Iowa, you explained the reasoning behind that nice title there, arisen during the pandemic when we have to knock and drop our resources. But I understand that you want to offer more than just food services, and you're rapidly growing nonprofit. What else?
Yes. We want to offer a Latino center. We don't have a Latino center where people can feel comfortable coming in and asking for services like translation services, filling out an application. As you know, as the pandemic hit us, I'm sure a lot of things are going to change in the future where you're not just going to be able to go to a place and ask for an application. A lot of things are going online because of that. So we want to prepare our community to know how to do a resume, have kids out there, because, you know, our parents, for example, myself, I immigrated to this country. So it's totally different from my parents to me now, because I'm so used to here. I've been raised here since I was a year old. I know how things work here. But my husband came in at 20 years old. My father-in-law could show him how to work hard and make a living and support his family. My husband just recently became a citizen, so he didn't know how to vote. So those are the types of things that we want to help our community, how to help our kids learn to get more involved, go back to your community and help them out, learn how to vote, know your rights. You need to do a resume? Sure, come on, let's do a workshop on resumes. You need to learn how to apply online. Your parent doesn't know how to apply online. You don't have Wi-Fi at home? Sure, come on, we'll get a computer room started or we'll get some laptops in here to help you apply for jobs. We want to do so much more, and we're praying that we can continue growing. We finally got our place of our own that we just got the keys on Saturday, and we're definitely going to need all that support and help from everyone to continue this welcoming spot, welcoming place for our Latino community.
Zuly Garcia, when you're offering these services, food services, and have a vision of future services, you're also helping our community members who are undocumented. How much is that a problem, a challenge, let me say, for those reluctant to reach out for help in food, for instance? They're in the shadows.
It's huge. You know, I've had families that, because they know who I am in the community, they feel comfortable coming to me. And they will tell me, we feel comfortable coming to you because we know who you are and we know you're not going to put us in danger. We know that you're going to help us through these times. And so, you know, it breaks my heart that they feel this way. And also, being an immigrant myself just gets to me, and it gives me the strength to continue going and fighting for the community that needs the help.
Oh, I can hear the dedication in your voice, Zuly. It's wonderful to have you as a member of our community. And with the changes perhaps on the horizon, DACA is again accepting applicants, and also maybe in the coming years there will be some immigration, comprehensive immigration reform from a federal level. That will dovetail nicely into the goals that you have for your nonprofit, won't it?
Definitely. We have another organization that's partnering up with us that has connections with attorneys, has connections with other things that we're wanting to bring to the center. And that's definitely something that we will be looking at to help our community, you know, for application purposes. I'm always working with other organizations to see someone's specific need. How can I get them help? And so being well connected and networking is definitely something that's important to us to get the assistance that our community needs.
Mm-hmm. You are based in the Des Moines area, and in terms of help, very quickly, because I want to have some contact information here too, the community there has really been a help to getting your organization starting and providing it with what you need to work, right? The food?
Yes, definitely. From all angles, we're getting all the support, and you know, it's amazing to receive the support.
Okay. Zuly Garcia, in closing, tell us how people can find out about more about your organization, Latinx Knock and Drop Iowa.
So you can either follow us on Facebook at Knock and Drop Iowa. You can follow us on Instagram. And we also have our own website where you can just go www.knockanddropiowa.org, or you can put it in as www.latinxknockanddropiowa.org. Either way, you'll find us, because we did it so many ways so it could be easy for everyone. What we liked about our website is that it's in English and Spanish, so you'll be able to read a lot of things that are from Spanish into English to translate it to, so you can see the support. We have our Facebook page there that's linked to our website, so you'll, if you don't have Facebook, you can still go there and look at what we're working on recently.
Okay.
But definitely check us out and help us out.
Latinx Knock and Drop Iowa. Zuly Garcia, thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a good one.
You too. Coming up after a short break, we'll continue another conversation about food insecurity, and then we'll talk to a physician, an Iowa physician, who was one of the first to be inoculated with that new vaccine. I'm Ben Kiefer, back with more River to River in just a moment. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, if you've been listening, you've been hearing that we've been addressing food insecurity in the state, as the economic fallout from the pandemic has left a greater number of Iowans without enough affordable, nutritious food. Well, let's finish up this area with a view of the central part of the state. Nancy Carroll is the executive director of Heartland Senior Services, Story County. Story County, including Ames, Nevada, Story City, Huxley, some of the major communities there. Nancy Carroll, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks, Ben, for having me on and for the listeners caring about this very important topic.
It is indeed. First, give us a quick idea of the food services you provide and how it works.
Sure. We are a countywide agency, and we do Meals on Wheels in conjunction with Mary Greeley Medical Center. Mary Greeley prepares all the nutritious hot meals, and then Heartland coordinates who is going to receive them, and then all of the volunteers for the distribution.
Okay, senior services, these are all folks how old?
60 and above. And, you know, we span, even folks are getting them still in their own homes. We have one gentleman that's 101 years old that still lives on his own and is a Meals on Wheels recipient.
Marvelous. So, Nancy, give us the picture, how it's changed where you are there with Heartland Senior Services compared to pre-COVID times. How much of an increase in need?
Well, we've had a 60% increase since last March 17th is when we got the notice that we had to close our in-house congregate meal program and our services within our building. And so at that point, we were doing 125 meals Monday through Friday. And then now we're up to 200 meals a day. Mm. So it's been staggering, you know, to have that kind of influx of numbers and need. And we're screening people, if you will, because when people need Meals on Wheels, we want to know what other issues are going on in their life. So we have a nurse that works here at Heartland with us, and she's actually doing an assessment on each of the people that sign up for Meals on Wheels in Story County. And so these people need the meals. We're not just doling them out because we're being nice, if you will. We're doing it because there's a need for a hot, nutritious meal so that they can hopefully maintain their well-being and not have to go to the stores frequently. They're all worried about COVID. And so it's a well-run program, and we're thrilled that we can accommodate that 60% increase.
The nutrition for the food, but, you know, the social isolation aspect of this pandemic means we have to all have nutrition for our souls, companionship there, too. So I imagine your drivers get the most appreciative greetings I could imagine. That's my guess.
Yeah. That's right, Ben. That's very insightful. And you know, we worry so much about the social isolation piece of it. And we did before COVID, because the 125 that were getting the meals then, most of them, again, are frail, and they can't leave their homes easily or frequently. And so Meals on Wheels has always been such an important program within the country. Yeah. And we're just glad and thankful that we can provide it here in Story County. Because the people do, and we work with our volunteers. You know, one of our training components is they're like a gatekeeper, you know, and so we try to have the same, if we can, volunteers generally delivering to the same homes, because they can develop a relationship with them and also notice if something doesn't seem right. And then they can notify us, and we can take immediate steps to help figure out exactly what's going on in that senior's life.
Okay. Nancy, a couple of quick things I want to ask you about before we have to move on here. We want to keep your drivers safe, and I know you do too. Well, what have been the challenges there?
Yeah. Well, when it first hit, we immediately got a hold of all of our seniors that were receiving meals, and we've tried to set up a situation where there's either a chair or a small table inside their door. So now the handoff happens via that table or chair. Mm. And so there's not the direct contact, and people are staying easily a minimum, if not 10 feet apart, let alone six. Everyone is masked, and we have had really zero issues because the volunteers have been so sensitive to this. And it's interesting. A lot of our volunteers, probably 85% of them, are over the age of probably 70. So it's been an interesting balancing act to make sure everyone is safe, but that really hasn't been a problem because we just addressed it right up front very proactively.
That's wonderful. And finally, Nancy, how's the funding going? With the increased need, you need to produce more food, you need more drivers, or they need to deliver more food. Talk about the funding and how that's been working out.
Yeah. Great question. Well, we do receive some federal funding, and because of that, we cannot require anyone to give us any specific. And each meal costs us a total of about $7 per meal. And some people in Story County can only afford 25 cents. And then others are closer to $5 or more. And so, you know, every year, We're always trying to fundraise for Meals on Wheels because we always have a deficit. because, again, some folks just, again, and it's legitimate. That's why, again, with our staff, we go out and we know all of our participants, and we know it's legitimate that they are just giving us 25 cents. And we say, great, it's the meal that counts, and we'll fundraise, so don't you worry about it. So it's always a fundraising effort, but, hey, that's what we do, and we're pretty good at it in Story County. People are very, very generous and loving towards our senior population, and we make it through every year very successfully.
Oh, that's so important. Marvelous work you and your colleagues are doing there. Nancy Carroll, thank you very much, Executive Director of Heartland Senior Services, delivering food and so much more to our seniors. And we appreciate the work of you and your colleagues. Nancy, thank you for giving us a snapshot from Story County.
Oh, Ben, thank you for including us. And we want everyone to stay healthy and safe, and happy holidays to everybody.
And back at you, Nancy. Thanks.
Thank you, Ben.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, now let's move on to the story of how Iowa's unemployment system gave workers benefits in this pandemic and then said, now you have to pay the money back. Tyler Jett is the jobs and economy reporter with the Des Moines Register. Hi, Tyler.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you for being on. You've got this three-part series, two parts of it out, about forced repayment of pandemic benefits. You focus on a number of people. Perhaps we can start by having you just tell us very briefly about one of the people you focused on here, because they are very powerful stories here.
Thank you. So one example of what we've seen in Iowa is James Furry. He lives in Dubuque, and he was working as a maintenance worker. He's about 58 years old in a nursing home up there, and his doctor called him and said, you cannot continue to work when this pandemic began. James has suffered multiple heart attacks. His father died of a heart attack. He's obese. He has COPD, so he has trouble breathing. And so he read about some new unemployment programs that would cover people with underlying conditions that would make them especially vulnerable to the virus. And so he applied, and he received unemployment, and we can get into some of the details of why later, I suppose. But basically, a couple of months later, he was told, oh, you don't actually qualify. And then a couple of weeks after that, he appealed, and a judge told him, no, you don't qualify. And then in mid-July, he got a bill back that he needed to pay, I think it was about $3,000 in his case. And so he's been setting up a payment plan. He is going back to work. Despite his own reservations about this. And so he had to go back to work, and then he began to set up a payment plan to begin to pay back his debt he has since accumulated. And he's been, when I reached out to him, he was as confused as anybody about what exactly happened in this case. He thought, I thought I understood the way that this program is supposed to work, and now I'm in debt.
Yeah. And you have other stories equally powerful. One of an 84-year-old cancer survivor in a similar situation, thinking that she this was benefits because of the pandemic, and then getting a bill for it later. You went to a lot of work, you at the Register, I assume, and colleagues as well, to find out how widespread it is. How widespread is it?
So the unsatisfying answer is we don't really know. How this started is I was going through what are known as administrative law judge decisions. Basically, you file for unemployment. If the case gets contested, if your employer says, I don't think that, you know, Ben should get unemployment, then somebody comes in the middle known as a fact finder. They listen to the reasonings on both sides, and they look at the rules, and they say, yes or no, you can get it. And then after that, you can appeal that and go further. And then a judge will review everything and make a decision. And once the judge reviews it, then it becomes public. And so I found these, I was just looking through judge decisions one day, just reading up on what was going on in some different people's cases. And I started noticing people that seemed to fit the categories for unemployment under the new federal program, Pandemic Unemployment Assistance. And they were being told, no, they didn't fit the category and they needed to return funds. So I did ask Iowa Workforce Development Director Beth Townsend in an email how many people received benefits in March and April when the pandemic began and were later told they needed to they didn't qualify and they needed to return funds. And she said that they were not tracking that information. So what we did is for seven business days, from July 23rd to July 30th, July 31st, we looked at every case, and this is about 525 cases. And I don't remember the exact number, but it's somewhere between 110 or 120 cases where people were told that they didn't qualify and they needed to return funds.
Mm-hmm. So out of 525 cases, over the judges ordering over 100 workers to return unemployment benefits.
And one important note on that is those are only cases that made it up to a judge, and a lot of cases don't get to a judge, so we don't know about those. And also, of the cases where the judge did order them, we did encounter some cases where I talked to people and they said, well, actually, the judge ordered that, then the state has never billed me, so I don't think I owe the money. I don't know for sure. I haven't heard, but I haven't actually gotten a bill for this debt yet.
Right. Wow. It sounds like a really murky picture that you'll be continuing to work on. Tyler, before we say goodbye, what will the final part of your three-part series look at?
So the next thing I'm looking at is another federal program. It's known as Federal Pandemic Unemployment Compensation. This was kind of a point of contention among some politicians. After it was implemented, this is the program that would pay you, if you're on unemployment, an extra $600 a week on top of whatever you are receiving from the state unemployment or from pandemic unemployment assistance. Basically, it's an extra $600 a week. You heard about that, I'm sure, a lot. Some of these cases where people have been told that they didn't qualify, they need to repay the money. Some of the cases, the judges have said, you don't have to pay back that money. You can go ahead and that will forgive that. It's federal money. You didn't mean to do anything wrong. You don't have to pay this back. But in other cases, people are still faced with those bills. And because that was $600 a week, that's a lot of money. That is more than the maximum benefit that the state pays out. So $600 a week is actually more than anything else you're going to have to deal with. And so that money really accumulated, particularly for people who don't make a ton of money. I did talk to a school bus driver in Clinton, and based on what she told me, she says she's making about $13,000 a year, and she's staring down a $12,000 debt right now.
Wow. Oh, that's tough. Tyler Jett, we'll look forward to more of your reporting. Tyler Jett is the jobs and economy reporter of the Des Moines Register, talking about his three-part series on forced repayment of pandemic benefits by the state. Tyler, thank you very much for the excellent reporting.
Thank you for having me on.
And to finish up this edition of River to River, the vaccination program began this week, we know, with shots from Pfizer, should soon include vaccine from Moderna, if that's approved by federal officials, as expected. On Monday, Iowa hospitals began vaccinating frontline workers. About 500 had been given their first round of shots by yesterday. University of Iowa Healthcare was the first in the state to start vaccinating employees with that Pfizer vaccine against COVID-19. Joining me now, Dr. Patrick Hartley. He's director of the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics Employee Health Clinic. This is where staff are receiving the COVID-19 vaccine. And Dr. Hartley is one of the 178 staff members who received the vaccine on Monday. Dr. Hartley, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
Describe that scene a little bit on Monday when you and other UI hospital staff were given the first of that two-step inoculation. You're a doctor. You've given a lot of shots. You've received some shots. Was this any different or run-of-the-mill?
No, this was very different. It was quite emotional, actually. excuse me. This has been a long slog for all of us, not just in healthcare, but for the community. And, we're still in the tunnel, but we're beginning to see some light at the end of this. We can't let our guard down yet, but it was pretty emotional. There was lots of, mixed emotions among all the vaccinees that came through on Monday.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about those mixed emotions. What are the mixed emotions specifically? Perhaps you heard others talk about their reaction to getting a vaccination. Relief, I suppose.
Oh, yes. Certainly it was relief, excitement, I joked with a number of them that, instead of checking your temperature when you come in the room, we checked your pulse rate, because lots of people taking selfies and other, as you've probably seen, some people posting it on social media. But we're all aware here that we're not done yet. And we recognize that even after your first shot, you haven't yet become immune to this disease. You know, it'll take at least your second shot and then a couple of weeks after that. So we have to remain vigilant, continue to use our PPE, wash our hands, keep our distance.
How many weeks will it take? There'll be a second follow-up shot. How many weeks will it take until the sufficient antibodies are built up that you have real protection there?
Based on the research that's been conducted, it will be about 2 weeks after your second shot. In the case of the Pfizer vaccine, the second shot is 21 days, so 3 weeks later. In the case of the Moderna vaccine, which hasn't yet been released, it will be 4 weeks later, the second shot. So you're looking at an average somewhere between, 5 to 6 weeks after your first shot. Wow. Before you will have developed sufficient immunity. But even then, we know that the vaccine is very effective, 95% plus, but there may still be some people whose response isn't as good as others.
So we're really looking for the first people to be immune because of the vaccine into practically February of 2021, aren't we?
Yes, almost. Probably towards the end of January into February before we've got the immunity among those groups.
What are you hearing as far as physical symptoms from the first shot? A soreness in the arm, like a flu shot, for instance? Any other physical symptoms you're hearing about or have experienced yourself?
Yeah, the side effects, and frankly, I don't consider these to be side effects. I consider some of these effects to be a good sign. That means that your body is responding appropriately to receiving a vaccine. So personally, I've had a little bit of soreness in my arm, but no more than I've experienced with other vaccines. About 24 hours after I received the vaccine, I had a low-grade temperature, about a 100.2. I took some Tylenol. Within an hour or so, that symptom had the fever had gone down and it resolved. And I've had no symptoms since, other than a little bit of soreness at the arm if I, push on the site where I was vaccinated. Some people report a little bit of achiness in the muscles, a little bit of fatigue. Mm-hmm. About 6-7% of people have a low-grade headache, after a vaccine. What's been consistently found is that these symptoms tend to resolve by about 48 hours following the vaccine, occasionally out to 72 hours. But this is no more than we see with many of the common vaccines that we're all familiar with.
And to your knowledge, in your circle there, caring for the staff members there at UI Hospital's Employee Health Clinic, no responses more severe than what you just described?
No, we've had, we've already surveyed some of the employees who received the vaccine in the first day or two, and the responses we've received indicate the anticipated level of effects. I think we had one or two employees that reported a fever, slightly higher fever of over 101. Mm-hmm. But again, nobody has reported a severe reaction to the vaccine, so we're pretty pleased with how things are going.
We're well aware that in the U.S. public at large, skepticism among many about the safety of this vaccine. Is that reflected, or to what degree is that reflected in the UI Hospital's staff? Because this was voluntary, wasn't it?
Yes, it certainly is voluntary. We have done a good job of getting out information about the vaccine. We have not required it of any of our employees. We've educated them, and our recommendations are driven by the science, the research. We've been very fortunate here that, at University of Iowa College of Medicine, we've been one of the sites that were conducting research on this vaccine. So we have a cadre of individuals here who have some expertise with this vaccine. Yeah. And we've been very upfront with our employees about the anticipated benefits, the potential side effects. In a survey that we conducted before we started the vaccination campaign, sort of over 80% of our employees, 85%, I believe, somewhere in that range, indicated that they wanted to receive the vaccine when it became available to them. So that's very encouraging. But for those decide not to. It's a very personal decision. We're not going to put any pressure on anybody. And we're available to discuss with them any concerns they may have.
Dr. Hartley, let me emphasize in the few seconds we have left what you started with. We are not out of this yet. There is some great hope on the horizon. But we have to mask up. We have to keep our social distance because there's still a lot of pressure on some very fatigued medical personnel you are working with, Dr. Hartley, and we want to keep that pressure off as much as possible. Keep everybody in good health. Thank you for sharing what you and your staff have experienced as the first staff members who have received the vaccine. We appreciate it, Dr. Hartley.
My pleasure.
That does it for today's program. Tomorrow on the program, a News Buzz edition. We hope you'll tune in. River to River, produced by Caitlin Harrop, Rick Brewer, Matt Alvarez, our executive producer, Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.